Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 195. It's Monday, January 23rd. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, while the respiratory soup that we've been in this winter looks like it's getting better, looks like the worst from the holidays, particularly with COVID, hasn't come true. COVID is still around plenty, so I would advise wearing a mask in indoor public places. Take precautions, but the XBB.1.5 variant is still coming over the country, but it doesn't seem to be causing a huge surge in hospitalization, so that's good news. Unfortunately, that's not the case with China. Yikes. This from Bloomberg. China's COVID deaths expected to surge to 36,000 a day over Lunar New Year. China is likely to see 36,000 COVID deaths a day during the Lunar New Year holidays, making it one of the most deadly periods of the pandemic, according to an updated analysis of the largest outbreak the world has yet experienced. The revised figures from the independent forecast firm Airfinity Limited added 11,000 deaths a day to its December 29th estimate, a jump that shows the breathtaking pace of the outbreak and the lack of clear information about how it's spreading in the world's most populous nation. The update is based on data from China's regional provinces combined with rates seen in other COVID-zero countries after they first lifted restrictions, a London-based research firm said. But there is little transparency regarding COVID in China, and it's politicized there in different ways as it is in many places of the world. This from Reuters. In China, doctors say they're discouraged from citing COVID on death certificates. During a busy shift at the height of Beijing's COVID wave, a physician at a private hospital saw a printed notice in the emergency department. Doctors should try not to write COVID-induced respiratory failure on death certificates. Instead, if the deceased had an underlying disease, that should be named as the main cause of death, according to the notice, a copy of which was seen by Reuters. If doctors believe that the death was caused solely by COVID-19 pneumonia, they must report to their superiors, who will arrange for two levels of, quote, expert consultations before a COVID death is confirmed, it said. Six doctors at public hospitals across China told Reuters they had either received similar oral instructions discouraging them from attributing deaths to COVID or were aware that their hospitals had such policies. We have stopped classifying COVID deaths since the reopening in December, said a doctor at a large public hospital in Shanghai. It is pointless to do that because almost everyone is positive. Such directives have led to criticism by global health experts and the World Health Organization that China has drastically underreported COVID deaths as the coronavirus runs rampant in the country, which abandoned its strict zero COVID regimen in December. The World Health Organization last Monday recommended that China monitor excess mortality to gain a fuller picture of the impact of the surge in COVID. Excess mortality is when the number of deaths for a given period is higher than it should be relative to historical averages. So probably well after the fact, we'll get to know. It's harder to hide the total death numbers and excess mortality in the long run. So eventually we'll probably get a decent picture. But right now, they're talking about everything being just fine and they're open. Okay, well, let's come back to the U.S. and do some healthcare stories, which of course usually means bad news. There's a little bit of good news, but it's mostly bad. First up, from Gallup, record high in U.S. put off medical care due to costs in 2022. The percentage of Americans reporting they or a family member postponed medical treatment in 2022 due to cost rose 12 points in 1 year to 38%, the highest in Gallup's 22-year trend. Americans were more than twice as likely to report the delayed treatment in their family was for a serious rather than a non-serious condition in 2022. In all, 27% said the treatment was for a very or somewhat serious condition or illness, while 11% said it was not very or not at all serious. Lower-income adults, younger adults, and women in the U.S. have consistently been more likely than their counterparts to say they or family members have delayed care for a serious medical condition. In 2022, Americans with an annual household income under $40,000 were nearly twice as likely as those with an income of $100,000 or more to say someone in their family delayed medical care for a serious condition. That's 34% versus 18%. Those with an income between $40,000 and less than $100,000 were similar to those in the lowest income group when it comes to postponing care, with 29% doing so. So basically, anybody with a household income under $100,000 has a similar level of delaying care. Yikes, that's a problem. Looking at gender differences in 2022, 32% of women and 20% of men reported putting off medical treatment, representing a 12-point increase from 2021 for women and a 5-point increase for men. The resulting 12-point gender gap is well above the 7-point average gender gap since 2001. And of course, last year, a lot of this is being driven and exacerbated by the high inflation rate. Although actually, medical costs have not gone up as fast as regular inflation, but of course, the out-of-pocket expenses, what's available in the family income to deal with medical expenses, is being strapped. And more bad news from Golub, as reported in The Hill. Less than half in new survey report U.S. healthcare is excellent or good. Less than half of respondents in a new Gallup survey have favorable opinions of the U.S. healthcare system, with a majority saying it is only fair or poor. It is the first time since 2001, when the Giant survey started recording feedback on healthcare in the U.S., that less than half of the respondents, that is only 48%, said the system was excellent or good. It continues a worrying trend of declining faith in the healthcare in the country, pollsters noted. Views on healthcare in the U.S. have degraded since their peak in 2012, when 62% of respondents had praise for the system. Since then, these positive views have hovered around 55%, dipping to 50% last year and falling below that threshold of half of respondents this year. The new survey found that one of the key reasons that attitudes towards healthcare have been on a downward trend is that the faith of Republicans in the system has deteriorated since former President Trump left office. In 2019, 75% of Republicans held a positive view of healthcare. Now only 56% share that viewpoint. Democrats have always had a generally lower level of satisfaction, sitting currently at 44%. The price of obtaining healthcare in the U.S. is another sticking point for respondents, with just 24% saying that they were satisfied with the total cost of healthcare in the country. And 56% of them said that they were satisfied with the price that they personally pay for healthcare, which is the lowest mark since 2016. I would note that whole Republican gap there and shift since President Trump left office, with increasing dissatisfaction among Republicans, ties into some reporting that I did an earlier show of the fact that Republicans tend to swing their levels of trust and satisfaction rather sharply based on whether a Republican administration is in power or not, whereas Democrats tend to have more stable views over time and over administrations. And patients aren't the only people who are dissatisfied with the healthcare system. This from Fierce Healthcare. Healthcare ranked lowest for employee satisfaction. Healthcare ranked last for employee satisfaction compared to 27 other industries, according to the 2023 Healthcare Experience Trends Report from Qualtrics. The survey of 3,000 healthcare employees across 27 countries paints a grim picture, reporting that only half of healthcare employees believe that they are paid fairly. 38% report that they are at risk of burnout, and 39% are considering leaving their organizations. Qualtrics also surveyed 9,000 consumers, finding that hospitals ranked among the lowest across the industry for satisfaction. What's important to understand about healthcare today is the extraordinary people that continue to show up every day, people who are intrinsically motivated to help others and support their teams. Caring for others who may be having the worst day of their life is already hard, Adrian Boise, Qualtrics Chief Medical Officer, told Fierce Healthcare. I think healthcare environments start to go a bit sideways when employees don't feel they are paid fairly, when time is spent doing menial tasks like typing, completing forms, repeating information, or filling in the electronic health record at night when they should be spending time with their families, and when their values are conflicted in life and work. Healthcare scored lower than the cross-industry average in workplace efficiency, which asks about both the processes themselves and the environment. In other words, do managers help prioritize the work to focus on? Do they remove barriers? This means the solutions have to equip managers with successful skill sets for their teams, and the process itself needs constant reevaluation and testing. When it comes to patients, Boise says they need to be given more input, more control. We are still building buildings without asking for meaningful patient input. And in more failures of hospitals, this from Axios, study finds hospitals are still not posting prices. Only 19% of hospitals fully comply with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services rule that requires facilities to post estimated costs for items and services, an analysis published in the Journal of General Internal Medicine. Well, I reported on this, and I've given the links to the local major healthcare systems to find those cost listings and posted prices. So if you want to do that, you can do that online. You can go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT, and I'll give that at the end of the show when I do the bonus articles as well. And in related news from Politico, patient portals digital divide. Black and Hispanic patients were less likely than white patients to be offered and use online patient portals. A new study from the Health and Human Services Office of the National Coordinator for Health IT found the disparities persisted even when adjusting for age, education, and other factors in the data for 2019 and 2020. The key findings? White patients were about 10 percentage points more likely to be offered and access patient portals that provide test results and other medical information than Black and Hispanic patients. About a third of Black and Hispanic patients access portals compared to about half of white patients. Roughly 6 in 10 people were offered portal access in 2020, up from 42% in 2014, a tally found in previous research. Why does this matter? Healthcare organizations are adopting digital health records to provide patients with easier access to their data. The sector hopes to avoid a digital divide as healthcare undergoes its digital transformation. And now honing in on the pharmaceutical industry, which means extra bad news, this from Medical Express. Less than a third of heavily advertised drugs have, quote, high therapeutic value, says study. Television ads for drugs are filled with glowing images of people living their best lives, all thanks to that new med they've been prescribed. But drugs being touted on TV often have little or no benefit compared to other treatments, a new study published in JAMA Network Open finds. Fewer than one-third of drugs commonly advertised in the U.S. are highly rated first-line therapies, based on regulatory reviews from three different health agencies, the researchers said. Further, medications categorized as low benefit accounted for nearly $16 billion of the $22 billion in TV ad spending during the six-year study period, the results showed. Proponents of direct-to-consumer pharmaceutical advertising often argue that these ads have high public health value by encouraging uptake of the most therapeutically beneficial therapies. Our study pushes back against this argument, said lead researcher Niraj Patel, a medical student at the Yale School of Medicine. Taken together with other research, our findings suggest that pharmaceutical companies focus their advertising campaigns on expensive, brand-name drugs that have little or no comparative benefit versus existing alternatives. Those billions spent on advertising do pay off for drug makers. TV drug ads reach a wide swath of Americans, and they influence a significant number to ask their doctor about one med or another. What's more, the ads translate into action. 1 in 7 people said they talked to their doctor as a result of seeing a drug advertisement, and more than half of those, 55%, wound up with a prescription for the medication. What our study does show is that drug companies tend to focus their advertising on drugs that are not necessarily the highest benefit drugs. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration could help the situation by being more proactive in regulating drug ads, Patel says. The FDA does not review and approve all advertisements before they air, and often have to play catch-up and regulate advertisements after they are already public. I think we should invest more in the regulatory process to catch misleading advertisements earlier. This could help improve informational quality by weeding out advertisements that have misleading content. The United States as a whole might also want to rethink whether these drugs should be permitted at all. The U.S. is only one of two high-income countries in the world that widely permits direct-to-consumer advertising of prescription drugs. And there's been a ton of empirical research over the past two decades that has suggested that this type of advertising can be misleading, lead to inappropriate prescribing, and inflate healthcare costs. Okay, well, next up from the Hill of an interesting follow-up on a story I did last week about the Shkreli Awards, which were about the greed and fraud in healthcare. And sure enough, this from The Hill, FTC asked court to hold, quote, pharma bro Martin Shkreli in attempt. The Federal Trade Commission last Friday asked a federal judge to hold the infamous pharma bro Martin Shkreli in contempt for failing to pay a $65 million fine and for violating a lifetime ban on working in the pharmaceutical industry. A federal judge last year banned Shkreli for life from directly or indirectly participating in any manner in the pharmaceutical industry. Shkreli in July announced the formation of a new company, Druglike. The company's press release described it as a Web3 drug discovery software platform co-founded by Martin Shkreli that purports to revolutionize early-stage drug discovery. Shkreli was separately convicted of securities fraud in 2017 and was released from prison last May. So immediately he got to doing more illegal activity.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, let's get to a couple healthcare stories that are a little bit better news. This from Mississippi Today. Poll says 80% of Mississippians favor Medicaid expansion. A wide majority of Mississippians across partisan and demographic lines supports expanding Medicaid to provide health coverage for the working poor, according to a newly released Mississippi Today Siena College poll. The poll showed 80% of respondents, including 70% of Republicans, either strongly agree or somewhat agree that the state should accept federal funds to expand Medicaid. The numbers appear to show a continued shift of voter sentiment in what has been a long partisan battle. Mississippi's elected Republican governors and other leaders for over the last decade have blocked Medicaid expansion via the Affordable Care Act and the billions of federal dollars that would have come with it. This resistance continues even as struggling hospitals and more citizens in the poorest, unhealthiest state cry for help. The poll showed large majorities across partisan and demographic lines strongly support the state's hospitals, large and small, being adequately funded, and a majority believe state government has a responsibility to help poor, working people pay for basic health care. Vast majorities, including 91% of Republican voters, agree every Mississippian should have access to good health care. Mississippi is one of 11 states to refuse expansion. The decision means the state is refusing about $1 billion a year in federal funding meant to help poor states provide health care, and leaving up to 300,000 Mississippians without coverage. Meanwhile, health officials say 38 rural hospitals are in danger of closure, in large part due to eating the cost of providing care to indigent patients. Some of those hospitals are larger regional health care centers, and even larger metro area hospitals are struggling financially because of uncompensated care costs. And part of the problem with continuing Medicaid expansion in addition to the last like 11 states that are holding out is Mississippi and other states don't necessarily have good laws around citizen initiatives, ballot initiatives, which have been very successful in other states. So really it depends on the state legislature doing it and the governors being okay with it. So it looks like the polls are very, very much in favor. This is kind of exciting news. A little surprising, except the fact that healthcare is such a mess that virtually everybody has to agree on it and is willing to, when there's a solution right at hand, might want to take it. Okay, well, and some more modest good news, but good news nonetheless. This from Stat News. Buprenorphine deaths did not increase despite wider access during pandemic, study shows. The onset of the COVID-19 pandemic led to a sea change in addiction medicine. In particular, increasing access to buprenorphine, a drug commonly used to treat opioid use disorder. Now, new data show that despite the medication's wider availability, deaths involving buprenorphine still constitute a very small fraction of overall drug mortality. The research published last Friday in JAMA Network Open offers new insight into the impact of emergency policies enacted in early 2020 to slow COVID spread while preserving access to addiction care. The changes allow doctors to issue new buprenorphine prescriptions via telemedicine, making the medication far more accessible to patients in rural areas or without access to transportation. Buprenorphine, however, is itself an opioid and is regulated as a controlled substance. While most doctors and health officials welcome the change, a small minority expressed concern that increasing buprenorphine access could have unintended consequences. I would include myself in some of that, not necessarily that buprenorphine is going to kill you, but buprenorphine actually is harder to get off of than heroin. So it's probably going to set up a lifelong other type of drug use, but it is very effective at reducing overdose deaths, which is not an unimportant thing. Those concerns were largely unfounded, according to the new research, which was authored by top addiction researchers at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the National Institute on Drug Abuse. While deaths involving buprenorphine did tick upward in the months following the policy changes, they increased at a significantly lower rate than overall drug deaths. Between July 2019 and June 2021, the share of opioid-related deaths involving buprenorphine dropped from 3.6% to 2.1%. Among those who died of buprenorphine-involved overdoses, just 20% of those were specifically receiving medications used to treat opioid use disorder, meaning the drug was likely acquired illegally. More broadly, nearly 93% of deaths involving buprenorphine also involved other substances, meaning that fewer than 1 in 600 opioid-involved deaths is attributable to buprenorphine alone. The study's publication comes amid a broader movement to increase access to addiction medications. In December, Congress passed legislation eliminating a requirement that doctors wishing to prescribe the medication obtain a special license known as an X waiver. Federal regulators also announced plans to make the emergency telehealth provisions enacted in 2020 permanent. In addition, COVID-era rules allowing patients to take home weeks' worth of methadone, another common and highly effective treatment for opioid addiction, will also become permanent. A similar study published last year showed that methadone-related deaths did not increase despite the new flexibilities. Separately, doctors across the U.S. have reported increased difficulty with buprenorphine inductions, or the process of giving patients their first dose of buprenorphine. As the drug supplies become more contaminated with fentanyl, buprenorphine has become more likely to cause severe withdrawal symptoms, leading patients to seek treatment using alternatives like methadone or to avoid a treatment altogether. Next up, from Medical Express, nearly 9 in 10 trans youth say recent wave of anti-LGBTQ policies negatively affected their mental health. The recent explosion of anti-LGBTQ rhetoric across the country is dramatically affecting LGBTQ youth, especially transgender and non-binary kids and young adults, according to a newly released poll. An overwhelming majority of queer and transgender youth in the U.S. say the growing number of policies restricting their rights have negatively impacted their mental health, leading to feelings of anxiety, fear, sadness, and stress, the poll found. A record number of anti-LGBTQ bills were introduced across state legislatures in 2022, more than 220, according to the Trevor Project, the world's largest suicide prevention and crisis intervention organization for LGBTQ and questioning youth. Late last year, researchers said the organization spoke with a national sample of 716 LGBTQ young people, ages 13 to 24, to gauge how the policies have affected their mental well-being. They found 71% of LGBTQ youth said they were negatively impacted by the flurry of anti-LGBTQ bills across the country, while 27% said their mental health was affected very negatively. Some 86% of trans youth, nearly 9 in 10, said their mental health was negatively affected, with 55% reporting being affected very negatively. 45% of trans youth reported being victims of cyberbullying last year, while 29% reported not feeling safe to go to the doctor or hospital when they were sick or injured. So far this year, more than 140 anti-LGBTQ bills have been introduced or under consideration in more than 20 states. Right now, we are witnessing the highest number on record of anti-LGBTQ bills introduced this early in a legislative session, said Casey Sofridini, VP of Advocacy and Government Affairs of the organization. We must consider the negative toll of these ugly public debates on youth mental health and well-being. LGBTQ young people are watching and internalizing the anti-LGBTQ messages they see in the media and from their elected officials, and so are those that would do our community harm, he added. Proposed policies include bans on LGBTQ-themed books or conversations about sexual orientation or gender identity in class, attempts to outlaw gender-affirming care, and trans youth sports bans. Protests against family-friendly drag events have also taken place in nearly every state. Next up, from Roll Call, Congress barely dents scourge of hunger in military. A recently enacted income supplement for low-ranking U.S. troops put in place primarily to alleviate food insecurity in the ranks will help less than 1% of the estimated scores of thousands of hungry U.S. military families, according to Pentagon figures. That statistic, which has not been previously reported, suggests Congress has a lot more to do to ensure service members who put their lives on the line for their country don't have to sacrifice food for themselves and their families. Fully 24% of active duty service members recently experienced low food security, meaning they sometimes lack quality meals, according to the latest Pentagon survey of troops in late 2020 and early 2021, before the recent inflation surge. Of those, 10% periodically experienced very low food security, meaning they sometimes ate less at mealtime, missed meals entirely, or lost weight due to inadequate food intake in the previous year. This, is to me, is just an example of some of the, you know, hypocrisy. In my view, this country considers military service and militarism, frankly, as kind of a national religion. And the hypocrisy that we lift up service members as being great heroes and, you know, even calling it the service with a capital T, yet we're allowing basically a quarter of those service members and their families to go hungry because of lack of adequate pay. Just gets back to the probably what trumps it all is that cheap capitalism just thrives on having poor people who are distressed. Yikes. And of course, this also gets to the fact that hunger and income or food insecurity is in fact a social determinant of health that impacts our overall health as a population profoundly across the board and across many sectors. And of course, there's often a gap between talking about something and actually doing it. And this next story gets to that as well from patient engagement. Few studies assess social determinants of health intervention by race. So of course, one powerful social determinant of health is in fact racism. And yet, few studies that assess social determinants even measure that. Here we go. Less than a third of studies investigating social determinants of health interventions include race and ethnicity in their analysis, and even fewer stratify intervention outcomes by race, according to a new study from the University of California, San Diego, health researchers said. This stymies any efforts to understand how social determinants of health interventions can address racial health disparities. Over the last decade, achieving health equity has been heralded as a key priority for healthcare delivery organizations. Health equity is achieved when all individuals have the opportunity to achieve their full health potential and no one is prevented from doing so. Achieving health equity requires addressing root causes of health inequities, including inequities in social and structural drivers or determinants of health. According to a literature review of 152 studies, the researchers found that very few investigations are looking at social determinants of health outcomes and race. Only 44 studies included race or ethnicity in their analysis. That means only 44 studies collected data about participant race or ethnicity. The remainder did not, hamstringing any efforts to assess how the intervention impacted individual racial groups. Of those 44, only 4 were conceptually thoughtful or explicitly or implicitly noted that race or ethnicity are markers of exposure to racism. This is a serious pitfall of healthcare experts designing social determinant of health interventions. Because of the persistent and pervasive nature of racism, it is likely that social needs interventions operate differently in minoritized racial and ethnic populations, the researchers explained. Failure to assess for differential outcomes by race or ethnicity prevents us from understanding whether minoritized racial and ethnic populations benefit from interventions at least as much as white populations, and prevents us from advancing our understanding of how social needs interventions can reduce racial or ethnic health inequities. Filling this gap is understanding will be critical as healthcare continues on its promise to address health equity. Since 2020, many leading healthcare organizations have committed to addressing health equity, but fulfilling those commitments will be fruitless if industry stakeholders don't even know how social determinants of health interventions can contribute to that cause. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. And speaking of health inequalities, this from Axios. Report says mothers in states with abortion bans are nearly three times more likely to die. Women in states with abortion bans are nearly three times more likely to die during pregnancy, childbirth, or soon after giving birth, according to a report from the Gender Equity Policy Institute shared first with Axios. The U.S. has the highest maternal mortality rate among developed nations, and government officials and health experts are concerned that conditions will worsen now that a federal right to abortion has been struck down. The report also found that infants born in states with abortion bans were 30% more likely to die than those in supportive states. So much for pro-lifers caring for mothers and children. Abortion is healthcare, and it's a human right. Okay, well, let's change base. I guess go big with this next story from Stat News. Leaders at Davos need to pay attention to the crossroads of climate change, health, and security. The summit at Davos aims to convene decision makers to come up with solutions to the key issues of the day and map the world's future. Climate change will be on the agenda, but there's a piece of the climate puzzle missing: health. It doesn't make sense to talk about climate change without talking about health. Poor health is a key component of vulnerability, and many of the world's poorest and most politically fragile nations lie at the center of a climate health security crossroads. Climate change is already fueling economic stagnation, food insecurity, water scarcity, and related health crises that are making living conditions in some of these nations untenable, and this will only get worse. Yet the COVID-19 pandemic highlighted the chronic underinvestment in health and the dizzying and unacceptable inequalities that still exist, such as nations in Africa being relegated to the back of the vaccine queue. The effects of climate change on health are already being seen in increasing outbreaks of infectious disease, polio resurfacing where it had previously been eliminated, one of the most recent outbreaks of cholera in Malawi, the resurgence of Ebola in Uganda, and more. These outbreaks will only increase as the world heats up. According to the United Nations, not taking action means undoing the last 50 years of progress in economic development, global health, and poverty reduction. Almost 100 million people are driven into extreme poverty each year because of out-of-pocket health expenses, and with increasing infectious disease outbreaks, climate change will make this worse. Successfully addressing avoidable health conditions would lead to an estimated $4.4 trillion boost in gross domestic product across all lower-income countries by 2040. That equates to an economic return of between $2 and $4 for every $1 invested in health. And while I hate reducing health down to cash, in order to, I guess, access to the minds and hearts of those people at Davos, you need to talk about money. Show me the money. But it does show that actually doing the things to prove health and public health actually is cost-effective and improves economic outcomes is not competing. In another worldwide issue, this from Axios, the struggle to contain the global threat of superbugs. Antibiotic-resistant superbugs are killing more people each year than HIV and malaria, but progress against them worldwide has largely stalled in the wake of the pandemic. Why it matters? As COVID-19 made crystal clear, disease doesn't recognize borders, and one country's problem can quickly become a global threat. The pandemic undercut years of progress fighting superbugs, in part due to overprescribing of antibiotics to patients and the increased use of catheters and ventilators that can lead to infections. The big picture? The World Health Organization in December chronicled increasing drug resistance in several bacteria causing common bloodstream, sexually transmitted, and urinary tract infections. Antimicrobial resistance killed nearly 1.3 million people worldwide in 2019 and factored in 5 million deaths in 2019, per a study from The Lancet. The CDC estimates the U.S. sees more than 2.8 million antimicrobial resistant infections and more than 35,000 deaths from them each year in the U.S. While COVID-19 commanded headlines and big funding, The world needs to prioritize resources back towards one of the world's biggest killers. Bacterial and fungi infections don't jump out at you the way a virus does, but we know the trajectory we are on is growing every year regardless. It will end up in a very bad situation that will be exacerbated that we don't have anything new. We've spent untold billions of dollars doing great work knocking back the AIDS pandemic and reducing malaria around the world. We are not treating bacterial illnesses with the same seriousness that requires governments to see the threat and act like adults. Well, this next story is a little striking, a little scary. This from The Hill. U.S. freshwater fish highly contaminated with forever chemicals, according to a study. Eating just one serving of freshwater fish each year could have the same effect as drinking water heavily polluted with forever chemicals for an entire month, a new study finds. The equivalent month-long amount of water would be contaminated at levels 2,400 times greater than what's recommended by the EPA drinking water health advisories, according to a study published in Environmental Research. The research added that locally caught freshwater fish are far more polluted than commercial catches with PFAS, so-called forever chemicals that are notorious for their persistence in the body and the environment. All 152 samples tested in the Great Lakes study had detectable PFAS and had overall higher levels of PFAS in comparison to those in the national assessment. PFAS contamination may be of particular concern for the Great Lakes ecosystem and the health of people who depend on fishing on the Great Lakes for sustenance and cultural practices, the authors noted. Contamination in the Great Lakes, as well as in other lakes and ponds, may be comparatively greater than the PFAS pollution in rivers and streams because these basins don't cycle as frequently. The water doesn't get flushed out as quickly. Median levels of total detected PFAS in freshwater fish were 278 times higher than those in commercially relevant fish tested from 2019 to 2022. It is incredible how different they are. Some commercially caught fish may be less contaminated because they are grown in controlled aquaculture environments. Meanwhile, large-scale ocean fishing often occurs farther offshore, where PFAS pollution would be more diluted. High fish consumption, eating one or more fish meal per week, is typical among anglers, individuals living along coasts or lakes, communities for which fishing is culturally important, and immigrants who hail from countries where fishing is a dietary staple, the authors noted. The researchers therefore characterized exposure to PFAS in freshwater fish as a textbook case of environmental injustice in which certain communities are inordinately harmed. And while it might not collect in fish's bodies as quickly, we do know from mercury, which has been around even a lot longer, that tuna, which is a tertiary consumer, meaning it eats fish that eat fish, that probably the health benefit you get that's often, for these, with omega-3s and all that kind of stuff is actually offset by the contamination with mercury. And of course, PFAS, these forever chemicals, are the rising stars in chemical toxic exposure. Okay, well, let's turn to the single largest preventable cause of death on the planet, which is tobacco. This from ABC News. Mexico imposes one of the world's strictest anti-smoking laws. One of the world's strictest anti-tobacco laws has been imposed in Mexico, setting in force a total ban on smoking in public places, including hotels, beaches, and parks. The new law, which is part of the country's general law for tobacco control reform, came into force last Sunday. It will also see the total ban on the promotion, advertising, and sponsorship of tobacco products. The sale and use of e-cigarettes and vapes are also due to face new restrictions. The new blanket ban extends to an existing federal and state tobacco control law, which came into place in 2008, banning smoking in indoor places such as bars, restaurants, and places. Bravo, Mexico! WHO welcomes such a bold move on tobacco control. We call on all countries to strengthen no tobacco policies and help us prevent 8 million deaths every year globally. Mexico, where the most sold cigarette brand is Marlboro, now joins nations such as Ireland, Greece, Hungary, and Malta as those with the most stringent smoke-free environments. Speaking in December 2022 on Mexico's road to tobacco control, Dr. Juan Arturo Sabines, Pan American Health Organization's national consultant, said the landmark measure would entail going up against one of the biggest, most powerful industries in the world. About 16% of adults in Mexico are tobacco users, and smoking causes nearly a million deaths in the Americas each year. Bolivia and Chile hold the highest smoking rates in the region at 40% and 39% respectively. Brazil, El Salvador, Mexico, and Chile are among Latin American nations also considering implementing tobacco control policies to reduce tobacco use, which kills over 8 million people a year globally. If you or someone you care about is interested in quitting smoking, you can use the Ohio Quit Line, which will offer resources and counseling for free. You can access that through 1-800-QUIT-NOW. That's 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Well, it's good to have good news, but unfortunately, a lot of times the public health news is a little taxing. So this story sort of gets at that. It's a problem, so to speak, that this show may suffer from. But here's an interesting story from Medical Express. Political news takes a mental toll, but is disengaging the answer? In today's highly polarized political environment, is it possible to stay up to date with the news of the day without getting totally stressed out? If not, is there a way to limit the emotional and physical fallout? Or is all that individual stress in service of a greater societal good? New research paints a complex picture with no easy answers. Well, what do you know? On the one hand, paying close attention to the daily doings of politicians does appear to have a way of making people feel consistently bad, investigators found. And those negative emotions appear to take a toll, they warn, in the form of poorer mental and physical health. On the upside, the study also found that staying politically informed appears to serve a larger good, motivating people to get more involved in important causes through volunteer work or financial donations. So this ties in some research I've reported on a long time ago on this show, and probably included in commentary previously. But that is that there is a difference between happiness and meaning. So that actually paying attention to reality can sometimes be a bit depressing. But actually, those people that have more accurate views of reality by paying attention to it, listening to the news, et cetera, actually have higher levels of meaning in their life. So if you want to be superficially happy and have less meaning in your life, then maybe just turn off the news. But if you think you can bear it and that ever-long quest for meaning, then pay attention. Not a bad idea. And next up, a refreshingly good idea from across the pond. This is from Medical Express. Beans in toast could revolutionize British diet. Scientists are aiming to revolutionize British diets by slipping more UK-grown beans into citizens' daily bread. Researchers and chefs at the University of Reading aim to encourage British consumers and food producers to switch to bread containing fava beans, commonly known as broad beans, making it healthier and less damaging to the environment. The three-year Raising the Pulse project was officially begun and was announced in January of 2023 in the Nutrition Bulletin Journal. Five teams of researchers within the University of Reading, along with members of the public, farmers, industry, and policymakers, are now working together to bring about one of the biggest change to UK food in generations. This is by increasing pulses, which we generally call legumes in the US. This is by increasing pulses in the UK diet, particularly fava beans, due to their favorable growing conditions in the UK and the sustainable nutritional enhancement they provide. Despite being an excellent alternative to the ubiquitous imported soybean, used currently in bread as an improver, the great majority of fava beans grown in the UK go to animal feed at the present. Researchers are optimizing the sustainability and nutritional quality of beans grown here with a view to encouraging farmers to switch some wheat-producing land to fava bean for human consumption. Fava beans are particularly high in easily digested protein, fiber, and iron, nutrients that can be low in the UK diet. But the majority of people are not used to cooking and eating fava beans, which poses a major challenge. Professor Julie Lovegrove is leading the Raise the Pulse research program. She said, "We had to think laterally. What do most people eat, and how can we improve their nutrition without them having to change their diets? The obvious answer is bread. 96% of people in the UK eat bread, and 90% of that is white bread, which in most cases contains some soy. We've already performed some experiments and found that fava bean flour can directly replace imported soy flour and some of the wheat flour, which is low in nutrients. We can not only grow the fava beans here, but also produce and test the fava bean-rich bread with improved nutritional quality. Raising the Pulse is a multidisciplinary program of research as part of their Transforming UK Food Systems initiative. As well as consulting and working with members of disadvantaged communities, there will be studies using our novel foods at the University of Reading Students Hall of Residence and catering outlets. This links Raise the Pulse with Matt Tebbett, who runs the university's catering service and leads the university's Menus for Change research program. He said students will be asked to rate products made or enriched with fava bean, such as bread, flatbread, and hummus. They will be asked questions about how full they felt, for how long, and their liking of the foods. It is hoped that the fava bean will improve satiety, as well as providing enhanced nutritional benefits in products that are enjoyable to eat. Before there are products to be tested, the beans must be grown, harvested, and milled. Raising the Pulse seeks to improve those stages as well. Researchers will be choosing or breeding varieties that are healthful as well as high yielding, working with the soil to improve yield via nitrogen-fixing bacteria, mitigating environmental impacts of farming fava beans, planning for the climate change, and more. Well, isn't it nice to see thinking big and actually doing something that hopefully will be a change that people won't even necessarily notice, and you'll have a boost of health for the entire nation. Way to go, UK. And in another proposed tweak to our food system, this from Food Politics blog, World Health Organization calls for soda taxes. The World Health Organization has taken a major step. It calls on member countries to tax sugar-sweetened beverages. Taxes on sugar-sweetened beverages can be a powerful tool to promote health because they save lives and prevent disease while advancing health equity and mobilizing revenue for countries that could be used to realize universal health coverage, said Dr. Rudiger Krech, Director of Health Promotion at WHO. Sugar-sweetened beverages, tobacco, and alcohol taxes have proven to be a cost-effective way of preventing diseases, injuries, and premature mortality. Sugar-sweetened beverage tax can also encourage companies to reformulate their products to reduce sugar content. More than that, WHO has produced a manual on how to develop and implement sugar-sweetened beverage taxation policies. Sugar-sweetened beverage taxes can be a win-win strategy, a win for the public health and averted healthcare costs, a win for government revenue, and a win for health equity. The manual summarizes everything everyone needs to know to justify taxes to craft policy. Get to work. Okay, well, that brings us to our last segment, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. I'll give the link at the end of the list. And this week we have 19 bonus articles. First up, the December omnibus bill's little secret. It was also a giant health bill dealing with mental health, drugs, pandemic preparedness, new Medicare benefits, and Medicaid expansion. So it's kind of interesting. You know, we don't see a lot of bipartisanship, but this basically took a whole hodgepodge of things that had bipartisan support and threw them in the omnibus bill. So if you want to get a little look at that and maybe even a touch of optimism of the fact that Congress can work sometimes, there's some good health care provisions in there. Number two, White House aims to reflect the environment and value ecosystems in economic data. So this is a very intriguing thing, and I think a good advancement, because of course GDP and stuff doesn't really include, you know, these external costs like the entire ecosystem that supports our ability to live on the planet. And you know, so for instance, you have a hurricane hit, and economists will say, "Oh, well, that'll expand the gross national product because we'll get to rebuild these homes," rather than looking at the loss and devastation in people's lives. So that's a good change. It's good to see that ecosystems are actually included in something we value. Although, you know, trying to reduce it all to money is a little difficult. But hey, if that's what we're going to do, we might as well at least try to include the value of such things as ecosystems in nature. Okay, bonus article three, very interesting article. This is from Scientific American. An old TB vaccine might help stave off diabetes, cancer, Alzheimer's, and more. So this is actually the oldest vaccine that exists, is for tuberculosis. And it seems to have a lot of effects. It doesn't mention in that and more is actually a lot of other infectious diseases. It seems to offer protection. So, hey, as research goes on, just proves that vaccination has a lot of benefits. Okay, next up, 4 and 5, a couple stories on medication shortages, supply shortage, and that type of thing. Why kids' medication shortages aren't going away. And 5, drug shortages are an urgent national danger. Here's how to fix them. So some solutions offered. And more medication news, bonus article 6, just say no to the medication switches dictated by insurers. So there are plenty of people, and this annoys doctors too, that basically their insurance changes their coverage or they change insurers, and you have to switch medications based on that coverage rather than based on any underlying medical need, and this creates a lot of problems. And in even more medication news, bonus article 7, hot mess. Abortion pills at pharmacies could face legal quagmires, especially in restrictive states. So this is a good summary of kind of the mess that's probably going to take a while legally and policy-wise to sort out. So if you want to get a good snapshot of that, read bonus article number 7. Bonus article number 8, mental health benefits of gender-affirming hormones for teens persist for 2 years in new study. So this confirms what was already believed, but it's been a very good, longer story that really honed in on the hormone therapy for teens, and the mental health benefits were good. And it showed that actually getting the congruence between somebody's gender identity and their body is really important. And if you miss that congruence by entering puberty, it's actually harder to get it back, and you may actually lose an opportunity to get the health benefits and mental health benefits from congruity between your body and your gender identity. Bonus article 9, racist beauty standards leave communities of color more exposed to harmful chemicals. So I've reported a lot on the fact that a lot of beauty products that particularly black folks use, whether they're hair straighteners or skin whiteners, these type of things, actually contain a lot of harmful chemicals. And of course, the use of these is often driven by racist beauty standards. So an interesting article there. And a few articles here related to COVID-19. 10, the costly lesson from COVID, why elimination should be the default global strategy for future pandemics. So this is really aiming high, but basically saying, like the way it was with MERS and SARS, which were the precursors basically of coronaviruses prior to COVID that were actually contained and eliminated, that should be the global default. But of course, it's going to take a lot of planning and a lot of resources, and a lot of equity issues have to be addressed to make sure that you can apply resources across the globe, regardless of whether issues arise. 11, the science and business behind COVID-19 disinformation and what to do about it. So this and bonus article 12, COVID-19 vaccines and sudden deaths, separating fact from fiction, are from one of my favorite little Substack columns, My Epidemiologist. And I normally don't deal with a lot of myths and disinformation stuff because, frankly, repeating this stuff, people tend to remember the garbage that you say rather than the countering of it. But she does a wonderful job of debunking a lot of these disinformation strategies and talking about the underlying dynamics of how that actually works and what you can do to counter it. Bonus article 13, health and human service policy for monitoring gain-of-function virus research unclear, government accounting office says. So gain-of-function virus research is where a laboratory virologists actually change viruses to actually become more dangerous by gaining different functions and then test them out. Of course, you want to make sure that you do this very safely in the lab. And they're basically saying that that a lot of this gain-of-function virus research, there are unclear guidelines around that. And this just gives me a chance to kind of reiterate what I've said many times before, is that people are talking about like the lab leak, you know, theory of like COVID and this kind of thing. And the thing is, whether we ever know that or not, the fact is we should be able to walk and chew gum. We should try to do what that one story, bonus article 10 says, is that eliminating pandemics before they get out of a particular locale or region should be very important. And we also need to be very vigilant around doing research around viruses so we don't have lab leaks. We can do both. It doesn't have to be one or the other. Okay, 14 is kind of a follow-up story I've reported the last several weeks about the health risks of gas stoves, and Scientific American here does a good job of summarizing the health risks of gas stoves explained. Number 15, it was a headline that made me laugh as a nutritionist. Reducing total calories may be more effective for weight loss than intermittent fasting. This just, I had to laugh because kind of the absurdity over, I don't know, the last, it's probably been decades, but a long time coming where people were basically, you know, in some binary thinking that somehow calories has nothing to do with weight. And there is a lot of interesting metabolic research showing that, you know, a calorie is not a calorie is not a calorie, that our metabolic state does affect that. And our evolution, since through most of human history we haven't had a lot of food, is geared towards actually saving calories. So we're kind of set to actually keep calories and keep weight. So there is sort of a bias that doesn't work well in the modern world where we're sedentary and we have a food system that, you know, teaches us to eat the kind of junk that all the food chemists want us to eat. But yes, calories do matter. Article 16, family dynamics and doctors' emotions drive useless end-of-life care, says study. So, you know, most people, when you survey them, want to die peacefully at home, but the fact is, because of family dynamics and doctors in the healthcare system, it's very hard to get that end result, and a lot of people end up doing a lot of useless end-of-life care. 17, another interesting story. Military probing whether cancer is linked to nuclear silo work. So this is an interesting intersection of a lot of things. First of all, when you get cancer clusters and something that you have so much cancer, this is basically a cluster for people, you know, working in this nuclear silo network. You know, it's kind of like, you know, Bob says, hey, did you know that Bill and Harry, do you have lymphoma as well? You know, you have so much lymphoma that people on every day can just kind of see it. Is kind of stunning. But it also brings in kind of an interesting link because nuclear weapons actually drove nuclear energy. If we did not have the militarized need for nuclear weapons, we would never have nuclear energy. Nuclear energy was basically created in order to produce enough raw material to produce nuclear weapons. That's a whole other story about the dangers of nuclear energy, but it all kind of ties in as a public health risk. No nukes. And 18, another kind of fascinating story from one of my favorite sites, Mad in America. Therapy beats drugs for depression for long-term outcomes. And adding drugs to therapy didn't help. If you're at all interested in that, there's a great story to look at the evidence behind that. And last but not least, bonus article 19. Researchers have followed over 700 people since 1938 to find the keys to happiness. And they've actually, it's up to several thousand, couple thousand people or so because they're following their descendants as well. Here's what they discovered. A little bit of a clue to that. It's about connection and relationships, the quality thereof. You can see this and other stories and all the stories I've reported on this and other episodes by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-